Hello, friends. Before we do anything today, I need to let you know that we now have a bookshop live on our website. And in that bookshop, you can buy the new book by today's author, Liz Porter. So stay tuned. There'll be more information about that as we roll along. The upgrades to our website, of course, would not have been possible without our wonderful patrons. So thank you so much, Louise Watson, Sam Anderson, Lauren Kerr, Tristan Miller, Jessica Waterson, Michaela, Gregory Roden, Catherine Deves, Marissa Hughes, Mark Foyle, Ellie Mitch, Wendy Emerson, Chelsea Liu, Robin Preston, Mel Brady, Jem Bentick, Scott Newman, Frank Mercarella, good name, Tegan Burford, and Christine Yom, and everybody else who supports us through Patreon. You can do the same if you wish to. Just go to patreon.com/osttruecrime. That's A-U-S-T, True Crime Pod. And you can become a patron and you get stuff for doing that. You get an extra episode every month and just other stuff, events and all sorts of things. And you also help us to improve our podcast and improve the stuff we can do with it. So thank you so much for doing that. Okay, on with the show. Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children. Liz Porter is a novelist and a journalist with a passion for the real CSI. It's a combination that means her true crime books read like suspenseful thriller fiction. And you're about to find out that that's how she talks too. She's a masterful storyteller, and the story she brings today is the stuff of legend.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Due to a bereavement in my family, I was unable to be part of this episode, so our friend Vicky Petratus filled in for me, which means that this week we lucky listeners get to eavesdrop on three true crime authors, Emily Webb, Vicky Petratus and Liz Porter, as they talk about a landmark case not only in Australian crime fighting but in international crime fighting. It's the story of the Narong Road Rapist. Liz Porter's book, Written on the Skin, features the story of the Narong Road Rapist, among others. So Emily started by asking her why the case is so significant in crime-fighting circles.
This is the first case in Victoria, and in fact one of the first in the world, where DNA investigation was crucial to the solving of the crime. In this case, it was a series of rapes by a bloke called George Gerald Kaufman, and the DNA evidence was never actually tested in court because he confessed, but he confessed to about 15 different rapes. And I think that without the DNA evidence, he probably would not have confessed. So these 15 unfortunate women would have had to go through the trauma of reliving it all in court. And because he confessed, they didn't have to.
So set the scene for us when this happened and what area of Melbourne it actually happened in.
It's extraordinary because the scene is the kind of the most unlikely place for a series of horrific rapes. It's actually a street called Narong Road in North Caulfield, which is affluent middle-class suburb. You know, the real estate agents talk about, you know, lifestyle, leafy streets. It's quiet, it's safe, very heavily settled by Jewish people because there's a lot of synagogues there and they can walk safely to the synagogues on the Sabbath. But in Narong Road, there were quite a few apartment blocks with lots of small studio apartments, which were, many of them, occupied by single women. And this was this rapist's hunting ground. And essentially, over 4 years in this area, he didn't only exclusively operate in Narong Road, he also operated in Armidale and areas around. But clearly these were the areas where he felt safe. He knew them. He knew Armidale because he lived there himself, and Narong Road he knew for whatever reason. And there were, as I said, apartment blocks. There was a handy lane on which many of them backed for easy access. And he was also a burglar, which is one of the reasons why he wasn't caught quite so quickly, because there was some dispute between the cops when he was first identified as a possible perpetrator. Was he a rapist or was he just a burglar and a druggie, actually, because he was also a heavy heroin user. I mean, it's a really interesting case because it's so like fiction. As a true crime writer, you always look for the cases that are actually like a novel. And here you've got a horrible perpetrator, but you also have a detective who is onto this guy, not from the very beginning, but fairly early on. It's quite a complicated case. So there was three waves of attacks of rapes on women. And of course, in the 80s, and this is something I had completely forgotten until some 20 years on, I was researching this book in the early 2000s, serial rapists. We don't have those anymore. We really don't. Thankfully, well, DNA, and I think the ubiquity of CCTV. I'm not sure what other theories there are for that. So there I'm sitting in the library in the early 2000s. I actually went back to the Age Library and we had a file there, just rapes, because all the reported rapes in the newspapers went into there. And at the time, there were about three different serial rapists operating in that area, not in Armidale, but in the sort of southeastern area of Melbourne. There was the Silver Gun Rapist, so-called, and a few others. And so the first series of rapes in 1982, and at that point, so there's five of them, and so the police response, and they realise that there are patterns and plainclothes police walking around the area at night trying to catch him in action, but they fail to catch him in action, and then it goes away. But still, there were chilling crimes. Basically, he would mask his face with a balaclava or with clothing. He'd have gloves or socks on his hands so he didn't leave fingerprints. Obviously, there was no DNA yet to know about he knew about fingerprints. But he left so few traces that when they did finally set up an operation to catch him, they called it Operation Shadow, because that's what he was. He was like a shadow. And so he would break in to the woman's flat while she was out, and he would sometimes burgle, and then he would wait for her to come back. And he, instead of bringing his own equipment, which would later possibly cause him to be caught, like bringing his own rope or tape or whatever, he would search her flat for things he could use to tie her up, pantyhose, scarves, whatever. And so he'd lie there and wait, chain smoking cigarettes, flushing the butts down the toilet. He'd arm himself with a knife or something that he found on the premises, or a razor blade. And then when she came home, he'd grab her, blindfold her, gag her, tie her up, rape her. Then he would demand money and then insist that his victims gave him time to escape, and he'd leave. So the cop who was in the group of cops investigating was a guy called Stephen Fontana, who was then 25. If people who are sort of keen watchers of real life crime, they would recognise him now as one of the several assistant commissioners of police. He's pretty close to retiring age, but he's still working. Well, he was an absolute gun detective in his day. He really was. So he concluded that obviously it's a serial rapist. They weren't able to catch him. And then suddenly the attacks ceased. So at the time, Steve was based in Elsternwick, and so that's why he'd been on the case. And then there were some more attacks in 1985. But at that time, there were so many other sex offenders operating, serial rapists and the like, that these rapes weren't at the time directly attributed to the same person who'd done the Narrorung Road rapes, even though one of them was in Narrorung Road. And the game was they didn't actually have a rape squad at the time. So they had no area, no possibility of kind of keeping a sort of a global watching brief on all the rapes and seeing patterns. They were just unable to do that. So those rapes kind of escaped notice at the time. But then in July 86, in Narrorung Road, again, a man with a balaclava over his head comes out of his hiding place in a Narrorung Road apartment, grabs the occupant and puts a knife to her throat and rapes her. And then there are a few more attacks there and in Armidale over the next month. And after the fifth of these attacks, they set up a task force to try and get this guy. And fortunately for the task force, Steve Fontana happened to be on it because he was a sergeant with the Caulfield Crime Car Squad at that point. And so then he was on to immediately the fact that there was a coincidence from the rapes he remembered from 1982. So he started trying to figure out, you know, what had this rapist been doing all this time? So he basically starts looking at the chart of unsolved rapes that they have and finds the patterns. And he basically narrows down 35 cases that he thinks might be attributable to this one person. So then they're basically waiting to get evidence to support his theory, you know. So then 8th of August, 1986, there's a woman who's living alone in Armidale. She gets home. Fortunately, she arrives home with her boyfriend, but there's smoke in the air in her flat. Someone's been smoking in there. She doesn't smoke. Her boyfriend doesn't smoke. To smell it, she knows something's wrong. She turns to her boyfriend and suddenly there's a crash inside the flat. Intruder had been waiting in another room. He rushes to get out. He knocks over a photo frame and he steps on it and breaks it and he gets out the window. And when she walks into her bedroom, she finds pantyhose and scarves spread across the bed. So this was exactly a classic work pattern for the Narrowing Road rapist, or modus operandi, as the cops call it. But on this occasion, he has left one trace. He's left a footprint on the glass of the photo frame. And it's an unusual footprint. It's got an odd circular pattern and it's characteristic of a certain kind of Nike runner. And the local brand that's available has a blue sole, they're told. And they've seen a footprint like this at a few other break-ins. This always happens on a Friday or a Saturday. Women go out on Fridays and Saturdays. It's when he used to break in and wait so he'd be there when they came home. So 30th of August, a ground floor apartment in Narrowing Road is burgled, money and jewellery stolen. But besides those thefts, he also stole pantyhose and he stole a kitchen knife and he'd spent time in the flat. He'd eaten chocolate, he'd been watching TV and smoking. And it looked like he'd been waiting for the female occupant to come home from her Saturday night outing. And Steve Fontana says, "I reckon he's going to come back." And he was so persuasive that they actually set up a sting for the next Saturday night in the expectation that this offender would return. This is the kind of thing that happens in movies, I think, to set up a sting, you know, for a rapist to be so sure that he's going to strike again in the same place. Anyway, Steve would have loved to have been there himself, but unfortunately it was the following Saturday, was the night before his 30th birthday, and he had the Saturday night blocked out for a celebration with his wife, and he just knew he wasn't going to get out of that one. So there's another officer waiting inside the flat. 9:35 p.m., the doorbell rings. Then he waits, and then an hour later, he hears a window being forced open. And of course, he can't use his police radio. And of course, this is pre the days of mobile phones. So he has to use the house phone to call the colleagues at the station. And as soon as he dials, there's a click and a ringing sound elsewhere in the flat. There's an extension in the flat, which again, I think we've all forgotten what it used to be like in those days, that when you had an extension, you could hear. So of course, there's a crash and the guy is running out of the flat. But within minutes, you know, there's the streets full of cops and cop cars. They seal off the surrounding streets. And, you know, by midnight, Fontana's there as well, birthday party forgotten. And they're checking the number of every car in the surrounding streets. And they also find out that night that there's a few other flats broken into as the intruder tries to hide. And one of those flats that he goes into was one of the ones where there'd been a rape some months earlier. And in one of those flats, they find another one of the Nike footprints. So they do all the registration checks and the calls, and they find that one of the cars in the street didn't belong to a resident or a visitor. It belonged to a local car yard, and the car yard proprietor, when visited by the cops, says yes, he lent this particular car to a mate of his, and this mate's name is George Gerald Kaufman.
What I find fascinating is, Liz, when you mentioned Steve Fontana says, "I know he's going to be back." And so many times on this podcast, it's just that copper's instinct, isn't it? It's just that gut feeling. I know you can't police solely on a gut feeling, but often you kind of have to incorporate it.
I've interviewed quite a few police officers who have that agonising choice between, do I go to my own 30th birthday / birth of my own child? Because I know that now is the time to get this guy. And it is a really hard decision for police to put their own life on hold. But I think for police, there's nothing more important than getting their guy. But this does predate. I remember going into the armed robbery squad in the early 90s, and they had an analyst by that time so that they could make these links. But it's probably cases like this that started this need for an analyst. We need somebody to put all of this together because the fact that in hindsight it's obvious, but no one was putting it together back then.
And they didn't even have a rape squad. And it was the formation of the rape squad was crucial to the solving of this crime, actually, or the two came together.
So how were rapes investigated then, under what department?
Well, just kind of local police. There wasn't a coordinated effort. And there's certainly no such thing as, you know, victim impact statements and things like that, even though actually Steve Fontana, at a different stage in the crime, did collect a whole lot of victim impact statements. He did interview himself all the victims and took down their experiences.
Think about coming home to an empty flat and having a masked intruder with a knife.
Worst nightmare.
It is absolutely your worst nightmare. And my heart goes out to the victims automatically.
It changed their lives.
Yeah.
You know, they are afraid to go out. Afraid to stay home, afraid
That's
to go
it.
Out.
You're not safe in your own home.
Liz Porter's latest book, Crime Scene Asia, is now available through our website. In fact, it's the very first book in our bookshop and we're very excited about it. So just go to our website, australiantruecrimepodcast.com, click on the bookshop tab and you can buy it. And if forensic science in crime fighting is your thing, then you'll probably really enjoy episode 44. Of Australian True Crime. The Malicia Trailovich murder is an Arel Fraser case. And in that case, a tiny tooth fragment was used to identify a victim. It's an incredible case, and you'll find the link to that episode in the notes to this one. Coming up on Australian True Crime, we find out where Kaufman was during his hiatus from terrorising the women of Caulfield. But first, more of the groundbreaking investigation of Detective Stephen Fontana, who is still with Victoria Police, by the way, and was appointed Chief Information Officer in April of 2018.
So, George Kaufman, he's on the radar now.
He's on the radar, but there's a long, long road between on the radar of the very good, inspired detective who is not the boss, and being arrested or having the evidence or even getting the backing to pursue this guy. Fontana tells the officer in charge of the task force that, look, I reckon this is him. But the officer says, nah, he's not a sex offender. His history is theft and heroin use. And famously, heroin does suppress the sex drive and the ability to get an erection. But of course, you know, with the wisdom of hindsight, this, I hadn't mentioned this trying to be delicate, but one of the issues in the rapes, often he would force them to perform oral sex on him and he could not get an erection. So, you know, it actually fitted the heroin aspect. So the task force looked elsewhere. They arrested someone else, but it wasn't him. But then in November 86, St Kilda Police, who had been told to watch out for Kaufman, spotted him leaving a motel and he was wearing rather distinctive Nike runners. Now, they didn't have a blue sole. They had a red sole, but they looked the same and they seized those shoes. So Fontana was pretty happy with that. So the shoes had to go off to the then pretty new police forensic centre in McLeod to be analysed with the shoe mark experts. And they go into the queue. It's not like, not CSI. They don't get a result that night. So he spent a Christmas, Steve Fontana, looking forward to getting a result. And in January, he had a result. The forensic expert said that the Kaufman shoe could be identified as the shoe that left the mark on that picture frame in that particular break-in. But still, they had to do a surveillance operation on Kaufman and they needed to catch him in the act. And they would start with getting him as a burglar. On the night of the 31st January, so another month later, a few cops are watching as they see Kaufman walk into an apartment block, go back to the car, get a jimmy and head to the property. Fortunately for them, the alarm goes off and a panicked Kaufman takes off and they grab him. The cops grab him and Fontana is kind of chilled when they catch him because Kaufman had always been very mild-mannered and polite when they had spoken to him. But this time he was like enraged, sweating, angry. And Fontana thought, yeah, this is what he's like with those women. This is the angry sex offender, you know. But then by the time everyone else got to the police station, Kaufman's back to being his normal, cool self. Anyway, Kaufman denies everything. He denies having left previous crimes where he's left the pantyhose out on the bed. So Fontana still wants to charge him with that, the previous break-in. charges him with the burglary and preparations to rape. And then around that time, Kaufman is about to start another jail sentence for that burglary, and his release date is set for August 88. But then a magistrate actually dismissed burglary charges against him on the basis that no jury would convict on the basis of a single footprint. So Kaufman's still going off to jail for something else, but as he's led off to jail, he calls out to Steve Fontana, "I told you, I'm not the rapist." And Fontana says, "George, I'll be waiting for you when you get out."
Never taunt a cop, because I've read so many stories about where they've taunted cops and cops have gone, "I will get you."
Yes. So Fontana still keeps thinking about Kaufman, but he's got a year of frustration because the commanding officer on the task force still doesn't want to hear what he's saying, that Kaufman's the rapist. He's saying he's a druggie, he's a thief, he's not a rapist, and he was the boss. Fontana was just a sergeant in the crime car squad. Anyway, he felt like he knew him. And anyway, that stakeout wasn't the only time he had, you know, he seemed to have a sort of a sense of what Kaufman was going to do. And that stakeout wasn't the only time he kind of read Kaufman's mind. A few weeks later than that previous one, he'd been investigating a break-in at a block of flats in Armidale, where a woman had fought off someone, a balaclava-clad attacker. She didn't know who it was, but it probably was Kaufman. Fontana had looked through the window into the flat next door, and there he could see women's underwear on a clothes rack. And he said, "He'll hit that flat." And he was really frustrated because he couldn't warn the occupant because she was out about the possible danger. An hour later, he was called back to the flat. There'd been an attempted break-in. Unfortunately, the woman wasn't home. But yeah, all he could do was just sort of write a report, put it on the file and hope. So then in April 88, things changed because Detective Inspector Danny Maloney asked him to join a new Victoria police team, which was aimed at looking at improving the methods of rape investigation. And so Danny Maloney was basically putting a team together, a sort of a prototype of what would later become the Rape Squad. Maloney had been looking at advances overseas, which included this new science of DNA, and he was very interested in that. So we're now in 1988, and as I said, the first case had happened in the UK of using this new science called DNA to actually trap a rapist and a murderer. It's a very famous case. There's a crime book called The Blooding by Joseph Wombau, which describes the world's first DNA manhunt.
And I think the offender had the most appropriate name for an offender, didn't he? Colin Pitchfork.
Yes.
I wrote a story where the offender was a guy called Brett Kilmore, and he had been involved in a couple of accidents, and one was a fatality, and he lived in Cemetery Road. Sometimes you just get these names.
Couldn't make them up. And if you put them in a novel, people would say, "Oh, you can't do that. That's just too obvious."
Truth is stranger than fiction, as they say.
Fontana joins this new group on the basis that he gets his way and he's allowed to investigate Kaufman as soon as he gets out of jail. Because in the meantime, the Victoria Police have been convinced by the arguments that the future lies with DNA, and they have been spending money on investing in new technology, actually thanks to the Labor government of the time, who was quite enthusiastic about forensics, John Cain's government. The then police minister, Steve Crabb, gave the Forensic Centre a grant of $100,000 to buy the equipment required to set up their own DNA lab, which they did by 1989. But so in the meantime, they decide to set up a joint police scientist operation to catch George Kaufman, and they call it Operation Shadow, as I mentioned earlier.
Had he left DNA behind?
Basically, what the police had were the samples of the women's intimate samples. In another sensible move, from 1982, Victoria Police had been storing, when a woman has been raped, she's examined forensically and they take scrapings from her vagina. So there's semen there. So that's what they had. So they had those samples to analyse. But what they needed was a sample from George Kaufman to compare it with. And that's what they didn't have. Because in those days, there was no legislation to allow police to seize any biological material or even fingerprints.
As we saw with Mr. Stinky, that was the, yes, you know, the quintessential, yeah, case, I think, that changed, yeah, everything.
Yeah, but it's really interesting. People like me, and I suspect you too, we're quite in our other parts of our life, probably pretty kind of left wing and, libertarian and stuff. But when it comes to stuff like DNA, I am so right wing. And I have a problem with universal DNA database. I always think if you haven't done anything wrong, what's your problem?
You know? I think every crime writer would probably agree with you.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting because it comes into the area of police powers, you know. And anyway, so there was no legislation. These days you can take someone to court and a magistrate will grant the power to take a DNA sample or fingerprints or whatever. In those days there was nothing. So they had to get it covertly. So the police staged a raid on Kaufman's house where he was living with his girlfriend. At the time, he was being incredibly well-behaved, no drug offences, no burglaries. He had a job fitting shower screens in bathrooms. Does it make you feel ill at the idea of all the women who didn't know that the guy that their builder had brought in was this man? Under the guise of a drug raid, because he did have form in that area, so they could justify raiding his house. So they seized sheets and they seized underpants, his and hers. They seized some chewing gum in the hope of getting a DNA sample from him. And in the meantime, the Victoria Police has been buying the equipment to do this magic new technology, but they don't have it up and running yet. So one of the DNA scientists, a guy called Stephen Kotowski, he's already been to New York once, taking samples from a Victorian case to be analysed there, and they teach him how to do it. He's gone there a few months earlier with samples from a Geelong murder case, and now he heads over there with these samples to analyse them. What they do to get a sense of what George Kaufman's DNA profile is. Fortunately, he has an ex-wife and he has a child. As I think we all know by now, a person's DNA profile is obtained. It's half from their mother and half from their father. So if you have the DNA profile of a mother and if you have the DNA profile of the child she has had with a man, then you can deduce what his contribution will be. So it's called an inferred DNA profile, because when they do the analysis of all the underpants and the sheets and everything, what they get is DNA of viruses, they get DNA of bacteria, they don't get any human DNA. But what they have is the inferred profile of Kaufman. And they do the painstaking analysis. They do it these days. A whole DNA profile is done, you know, less than a day. In those days, they would do one point on the DNA molecule at a time. And so the detectives were back in Melbourne waiting. Okay, there's this point. It looks like it could be him. It was a very painstaking process. Anyway, to cut a probably an excessively long and scientific story short, it was him. They established that his DNA was a match to all those crime scene samples. They had enough to actually sit him down, interview him and charge him. And he confessed because the evidence was so overwhelming. And the good thing was that it saved, as I said before, all those victims the ordeal of having to go through it all in court. And so this was the first case with DNA evidence in Victoria. There had been one case in Canberra of a guy called Desmond Appleby, who had actually faced trial for a rape case, and they had used DNA evidence that had been done, I think, in the UK. And there, that's historically the first case in Australia, but that was actually in 89 after Kaufman had been charged and everything. But they actually went to court and was tested in court, and the evidence stood up.
So did he explain his hiatus?
He's in jail. That was the thing. That was the other thing that Fontana later realised in terms of his certainty that this rapist was Kaufman, was that the times where there were no offences in Narrowing Road and Armidale were the times when George Kaufman was in jail.
When you looked back over the newspaper files, was there stories at the time of the fact that there was a serial rapist out there?
Oh, yeah. There were lots. That was the thing. There were, as I said, the silver gun rapists. There were a few.
Mr. Stinky, I think that Raymond Edmonds was one. And did George have a media headline name? Or
no, because he basically didn't hit the headlines until he was really charged, And in fact, I can remember when the story hit the headlines, I was in my first year at the Sunday Age and this was a new newspaper. And I thought, gee, this is really interesting. And I actually, on the basis of that, I went out to the McLeod Forensic Science Lab to do a story on what they're up to out there. It's hysterical because I remember, I just can't believe how much freedom I was given. In fact, I'd forgotten when I was out there, it was 1989. And when I was researching Written on the Skin, that's 2004 or five, I knew, and I've worked in Sydney and I'd done a lot of police things, and I knew I'd been to a police crime lab, but I actually couldn't remember whether it was Victoria or New South Wales. But I had very strong memories of being there and being shown, you know, the way cops do, show you awful crime scene photographs and things and try and shock you. But sometime around the time as I was writing this book, my then partner produced this long rolled up printout, because I used to bring my printouts home from work, and he'd found it in his desk and he said, look at this. And it was the story of me going out to McLeod. And I'd been wandering around there. I'd documented the fact that there was a big whiteboard with number of DNA cases, what the delay was, what the backlog was.
Oh, wow.
They'd let me look at all that.
I too was out at McLeod. It's funny, when crime writers get together, there's always a me too kind of aspect.
Yeah.
But I too remember going out there, and there had been, just prior to my visit, there'd been, someone had attacked somebody with, it was like a sword. And they'd smashed a window. And so I went into a room where on a table was this window, like a big giant jigsaw puzzle,
yeah,
putting the window together, and the sword was there. I guess they were trying to find marks from the sword. Not quite wandering around, but certainly been left in a place with boxes of materials. But I don't know that you'd ever get to do that now. We were novelties in those days. I remember going into police stations and saying, oh, you know, I want to write a book, and could I interview someone? They're going, oh, that sounds cool, sure. Now, you know, the police have their intellectual property, and there's, you have to jump through so many hoops that I don't actually approach them anymore. But back then it was, you know, probably a similar time.
Mm. Oh, yes. I couldn't believe it. And the fact that they were so open about their backlog, and here I'm a journalist and I'm writing it all down, and it goes in the story. That's the thing. And this is one of the reasons why I'm now doing my PhD on the history of Victoria Police forensics, because it's an amazingly interesting story, because they were only the fourth police lab in the world to do their own DNA, which is pretty amazing, little old Victoria.
Yeah.
And we were only the second jurisdiction in the world, like ahead of anywhere in America, to have our own DNA database. First, the UK had theirs first in 95, and then we passed the legislation to set one up in about 97. And 98, we had our first cold case hits from a DNA database, you know, where there's an unsolved crime and then somebody gets arrested at an unrelated crime, their DNA is taken, and then lo and behold, it matches a crime that had been until that moment unsolved.
And so what happened to Kaufman? What kind of sentence did he get?
He got 21 years, but he was then released after 14 years because of this now abandoned policy of remissions for good behaviour. But he refused when he was in jail to do the sex offenders course.
And I think now if you refuse to do it, that you can't get parole.
Yeah,
I think that's,
it's unfortunate. Yeah. But I have no idea, you know, where he is now.
How old would he be now, do you think?
He was born in 1949.
Okay.
He had a tough life, not that that's any excuse. He was born in a DP camp, displaced persons camp in Europe.
You've written a few other books, haven't you, Liz? What are the names for our listeners?
Well, my second book, because after I wrote Written on the Skin, as I said, which I looked at every possible kind of forensic analysis from bloodstains to documents to bones, then I thought, well, I can't do that again. So I didn't do another book until I got another idea for something different, which was Cold Cases. And so the second book's called Cold Case Files. And then again, I thought, oh, I can't do that one again, even though there's zillions of cold cases that are interesting, but I thought, no. So then when I was in Singapore for a conference, I came up with the probably spectacularly stupid idea of doing a book about forensic science cases in Asia, which is called Crime Scene Asia, and that came out just last year. I'm told it's an interesting read, but it was a very hard book to do.
There's not many people doing, I think, specifically focusing on, yeah, and we are in Asia, so
That's
a good one to.
But there's hardly anybody focusing on specifically on forensic science, and there's a very good reason for that, because it's really, really, really hard, and in fact doesn't sell as well as fiction. My feeling is people are more interested in forensic science when it's sugar-coated in fictional form.
In CSI form.
Yeah,
and I think Patricia Cornwell.
Yeah.
I just have this knack for choosing an area that is supposedly commercial, but then finding the one area in it which is not commercial.
It's like writing books, so it's like a crazy passion, isn't it?
And you can't help what your interest is.
Well, that's right.
And if you wrote for someone else's interest, you know, maybe you couldn't do it.
Yeah, but, you know, as all the go these days is podcasts about unsolved crimes. Well, I only, by definition, look at solved crimes because I want to look at what the forensic scientists have done to solve them.
I did see a rather funny comment on social media on a podcast fan page that said, can anyone recommend a podcast that really goes into the detail of forensics? And I wrote, read the book.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
Because the books always do.
Yes.
And this commenter hadn't thought
to read
go
a book.
To a book. Read the books, people.
I mean, it's extremely difficult, as you guys both know, to explain exactly how DNA works, but you can have a shot at it on paper. It's just far too complex to do in a podcast. You just send people to sleep.
Well, I suppose that's what we've got to expect when we let authors loose on a podcast. They are all excellent authors. Their books are excellent and very detailed. So, yes, read the books and listen to the podcasts would be my advice. Thank you so much to Vicky Petratus for filling in. I love her voice. She's got such a beautiful voice. I hope we hear more of it. And thank you to you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. Liz Porter's book is Written on the Skin. That's the book that this story that we heard today is featured in. But also don't forget her new book, Crime Scene Asia, is available from today from our website, australiantruecrimepodcast.com. Just hit on the bookshop tab. It's the very first book available from our bookshop, and we are very proud of that. We'll be back next week with another episode of Australian True Crime.